So this is continuing with Cyril Hazard on 3rd June 1981. I was saying that it seems odd to me to have these passive and active observations going on at the same time. Does that create interference or conflict between groups as to when one could observe or do certain tests?
Could only complicate the thing very slightly, and you have to have suppressors and so on built in. I mean, we do a series of pulses piped around, really from the radar pulses, and we just suppressed. At that time, internally, but kind of overrunning.
It wasn't a big problem.
It wasn't a major problem. It just meant you had to have stuff you would normally have to have in there.
Well, let me ask a question which you were touching on there, namely, what do you think, going up until the early 60s, was the major thing that radio astronomy or things that radio astronomy contributed to the development of astronomy as a whole?
In retrospect, I mean...
Yeah, as you see it now.
Oh, I think the recognition of the... it was all leading up to the role of the nucleus, I think, in the galaxy in retrospect. I mean, I think one can say that the double radio sources and all that sort of thing was pointing to the fact that you had an active nucleus in the galaxy looking back. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the subject has been dominated to a big extent by the cosmological aspects as well. I mean, I think that once it was realized that these things were very distant and you could really do cosmology with them, that's played a very large role. Now, I'm not quite sure, I mean, well, that's been terribly fruitful, I mean, looking at what's been achieved by the amount of effort that's gone into that particular part of it, that the radio sources evolved and so on, I think we know now, at least they evolve and that there are density changes and so on.
So you're not sure that it's really given us a greater understanding of cosmology, but in any case, it certainly had a large impact on cosmology and the way it was done. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that a lot of radio astronomy, the emphasis was on cosmology, partly because of the controversy over the steady state.
Right. Well, I want to come back to that question.
One associates a lot of it too much with that aspect of it, because perhaps it was much more important, I think, recognizing what was going on in galaxies and so on, that these weren't simply passing objects just sitting there. And perhaps I think we had to try to make the jump now right the way out and go to very distant things. We might have built up a better picture of what was going on more locally and set a better foundation for some of this. It was important, I think, because it started and led eventually to the recognition of different types of objects that people have been familiar, at least were really aware of, I think. I mean, safe galaxies and so on, and obviously been found beforehand, but the role really wasn't recognized at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It led to the recognition of these type of objects, the interesting objects which brought... it was a method of locating potentially interesting parts of the sky as well, the radio surveys and so on.
What about, do you see any contributions from the way radio astronomy was done, the attitude or the methodology as having an influence on optical astronomy?
Not until very recently, I don't think.
What do you mean by very recently?
Well, I think that I don't know whether it had an impact or not. I think that I would say that radio astronomy, by bringing into optical astronomy people who were with very strong engineering backgrounds and so on, and very familiar with the extremely complicated radio astronomy techniques which were developing by the 1960s and so on, had a big impact, I think, probably on the way telescopes and so on were designed. I mean, I think it was probably a bit frightening to an old-fashioned optical astronomer to contemplate, you know, highly sophisticated guidance things, telescopes and second of arc and telescopes. So I think that that sort of stuff, computers, things and everything, seemed to come much easier to some people in radio astronomy.
That's late 60s, really, before that had an impact, would you say?
I'm not quite sure, but I suppose that the Parkes radio telescope, the Parkes radio telescope, I mean, must have had some influence on the design of the AAT.
Well, of course, John Bolton was
that's
on
what
the...
I mean. That's what I mean. I think that...
He was on the design committee for the AAT.
So you had people who designed, being involved in the design of these...
But you don't think that radio astronomy was influencing how the optical people did their research or how they thought about things very much in the 50s?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one or two exceptions. I think that Bird, I think, obviously recognized Bock, I think, probably did, and obviously Minkowski did. Varda, I'm not sure. I mean, probably Varda, you know, it seemed to me Minkowski did more. And that's all. There were one or two people that were...
But these were the exceptions.
I think they were the exceptions. I think it's probably the way that... it's probably... an accident as well. Well, not so much an accident. I think that radio astronomy, to some extent, got itself going for historical reasons in England and Australia, who didn't have optical telescopes. And therefore they got well underway because there was no competition. All the people who were getting into astronomy worked on radio telescopes and so on.
Right.
Whereas when you had the big optical telescope, after all the 200-inch had just come into operation at Palomar and so on, so there was a big resurgence, of course, in optical astronomy at the time.
And in the States in particular.
In the States, and I think this is possibly why radio astronomy never really got cracking in the States.
Interesting point. Until
a long time afterwards. And so there was, by that very nature, there was a physical barrier. It wasn't as easy to fly around in those days as it was later on.
Well, nor was there the tradition of observing on telescopes that were not your own, and you used your own instrument.
That's right. So that to a certain extent, I think that these two things developed. Certainly, the radio astronomy where there wasn't any optical astronomy, and the optical astronomy where the optical astronomy was, the radio astronomy did develop for some reason. And the breakthrough there, of course, to some extent, was I suppose that. On the Australian side with John Bolton and then going to Caltech.
In terms of helping US radio...
Well, I think I'm not quite sure whether that was the first one, but in the midst of extragalactic work and so on, that was probably the first real sort of working contacts between the optic and the radio, I should think, where they were in the same building, where they were in the same place and were collaborating directly.
Yeah, the only other close association between... optical and radio had been at Harvard, which was all the 21-centimeter galactic structure.
On that sort of thing, yeah, the galactic structure, I think, you know, forms a separate...
Right, but for extragalactic, I think that's a fair statement, right? Just an odd question here. In a previous interview, you mentioned Hanbury Brown's drift experiment.
Did I?
Which is how it came across, anyway, which was never done.
Oh, sorry, I'll tell you what it was. When
I
went to Jodrell originally, I went about the same time Henry Brown arrived. Now, I worked with Alan Maxwell and Gordon Little for a few months, and then I went over to work with Henry Brown on the 210-foot. And the project which he'd inherited from Vic Hughes, who was doing radar stuff and so on as well, was to... used the 210-foot fixed telescope to investigate the spectral variations in a strip of sky in the zenith at different frequencies, in which you'd look at 75 megahertz and something else, and I think it was the different frequencies, and to anyhow to map the distribution. In the zenith, just as the sky drifted round.
So the drift refers to just drift scans.
Drift scans around. And that was what we started off to do. And it was when it originally arrived, Andrew Brown had suggested that you could, I think possibly based on Reber's work, I'm not very familiar with the very early stuff, you could detect M31, and that if the telescope could be tipped over that far. And so that we started to tip the telescope over by this very laborious method of screwing cables and tipping it over.
Well, can you describe to me exactly what you had to do and how long it took to tilt that telescope?
Oh, it took... it would take most of the day to tip it a few degrees.
And how many people?
Two of us.
And what did you have to do?
Well, it was guided by three sets of cables, just placed equally around the thing. And what we'd do is one set of cables would be pretty well north-south, I think. And so there's one set of cables would be there. Maybe the four sets of cables. Right. And what we would do is one of us would go to each side of the telescope, to each set of cables, one on the east and one on the west, and we'd slacken off these cables there'd be about six cables, I think, running up the total height of the mast, and we'd slacken these cables off by a certain amount, and then we'd go around to the other cables, and we'd then start to release them and pull them in the other direction, in the north-south direction, and tip the thing over. And you, of course, when you did this, the whole thing started bending.
Right.
Sort of shape, and you had to keep on trying to keep the thing reasonably straight and hoping it wouldn't break at any particular time. And I can't remember how long it took to tip it over, say, to 20 degrees to get, it wouldn't be 20 degrees, 15 degrees to get to M31. But typically we would change it by the order of a degree or so in a day, and that would take us probably a whole afternoon or more, because it would be, it would be snowing, you know. And
then how did you know where you were?
Well, then we put a couple of theodolite stands in the end at two of these more or less right angles, and we measured the position of the top of the tower. And then just worked out what angle it was tipped over, and we had some relationship between the angle of tilt and some papers.
Right. Well, you worked that out in your thesis.
Something like that.
Okay. It turns out, by the way, that detection that Reber claimed was certainly spurious. I mean, it came out to a very much intensity at his frequency, which is just about the same as yours, 160 megahertz.
That's right. I think so. Yeah.
But in any case, that was part of the motivation, apparently. You know,
I think that was totally part of the motivation.
And you realized that, of course. I'm quite sure you discussed that in your
I don't know whether we discussed it. We didn't believe that it detected it. That's what I think.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, because you had a much weaker signal than his would have predicted. Okay. Well, now I'd like to jump to the whole business of the log in, log s counts, the 2C survey, and so forth. And at least the one place where you published something on this was in an article with Walsh in 59, which was also presented at the Paris Symposium.
Yeah.
And basically it seems that you had an interferometer survey and a single dish survey, and you compared these to see what the reliability was. And you found that it was a certain level below which you couldn't trust.
Yeah.
And that corresponded to one every 25 beams or something.
Yeah.
Now, was that the first indication that that you had to have such a low density of sources before it was reliable, or?
I can't remember, actually. What happened? That there was problems with the beam, which I knew a long time before that, and I'll tell you how that happened. I don't know if we ever published this at all. Yes, we did. Maybe it's published in a paper on where we discussed a model of the galaxy in Philosophical magazine. What happened once was Piddington had published a set of papers, I think, in which he claimed that the width of the thing across the galaxy was a function of frequency. And
right.
I remember looking at that one night and saying to Henry Ronnett, I'm looking at something odd here, because the width he's getting is the beam width in every case.
Right.
But it was then we realised that you couldn't go below the beam width. I mean, we didn't do much about it. I mean, that was the sort of stuff that Brace was and so on.
Right.
And I can't remember what we did about that, but we realised then that all these restoration techniques, there were serious problems with the beam width. Now, why we got involved in the... I think that it happened because... I mean, other people did come about the same time, the same conclusion, I think, Pawsey, but we didn't know anything about that, as far as I remember. And what happened was, I'd been away from George Lussat, and I went back, and I originally started working with Palmer and on the interferometer, and I sort of designed some antennas for that, and gradually I drifted back into the... I went to work with Dennis Walsh on the fixed one, which had now got a pole which you could press a button and move the... it'd been a new central mast constructed for 210 foot.
Yes.
And you could now just automatically move it up and down.
I see.
And we decided, for some reason or other, to do an interferometer survey of the sources at 92 megahertz. We went and built our own antenna.
So you're not sure that the motivation to do that really was to investigate this problem? And that was maybe...
That's what I can't remember now. You talked to Dennis about it?
Yeah, well, I undoubtedly did. I can't remember, to be honest. It was many years ago that I interviewed him.
I'm trying to think whether... No, I've got a feeling that we did it. That we did it deliberately. To investigate the problem. I'm trying to think. Yes, we did. We realised that we did do it to investigate the problem. But I'm trying to remember why now.
Well, it was a very big controversy at that time, of course.
Well, yeah, but I can't remember that... Yes, but I can't remember... Confusion wasn't a big issue, was it, at the time?
Well, I think so.
See, I remember when Scheuer came to Jodrell to talk about some of this stuff, and that was early on. We said to him then...
Now hold it now, this would be when now, before you went into the Army?
57 or something. When the 22C first came out...
Well, that was 54 or 55.
Well, all right, so it must have been about 57 by the way. When I got back to 57, I can't remember. Exactly.
But now you're talking about Scheuer coming up in 57 or so?
But I remember when this thing first came up and they were first putting forward the results and so on this sort of thing, and he came actually to discuss the probability distribution, what he'd been doing that day.
Right, the P of D business.
And we said, we said to him then that surely the thing was confusion limiting. And I remember him saying then, which was the usual thing, that there was less than one source of beam area, and we knew at the time that the problem was much more serious than that. Now, I can't remember why we knew, that's the trouble, but we knew that the problem was much more serious than that. Now, some of the problems had cropped up earlier on because certainly before 1954, we'd found all these sources in the galactic plane, and when Ryle was up there and some others. They hadn't found them in the streets interferometer surveys, and they were very lucky to believe they were real at the time. And we checked some of these out by looking for caves by using interferometers and so on, which was the first time we really got involved in any of that sort of stuff. They were a bit black and blue, so we were interested, I think, from then in the differences as to what you were seeing with interferometers and what you saw on the pencil beams anyhow. So we've had some interest
in
that sort of problem. There were differences turning up between the two types of observation, and I think which we wanted to investigate.
Now, why had not Ryle seen...
Because they were extended. Now,
because they were extended, okay.
Yeah, it's rather interesting, actually. Before I went, I left traveling in about 54, I'd looked at all these things. I'd measured all their angular sizes, actually. And I didn't publish it, but I'd measured them. Because it was a bit difficult to measure heart widths and so on. But in fact, when I was away, they measured them at Drodwell using the interferometer, and they were the same angular sizes. And I remember when I went back, I just opened my drawer, but all my stuff was still there.
Yeah.
And I just opened the stuff, and there were all these angular sizes all written down on the sheet of paper, which were all right, but I wasn't confident enough then to realise that, but I think, or if I was leaving anyhow at the time, I suppose, I might have done something I'd stayed. But in fact, we'd realised these sources were being extended sources in vain anyhow. The 1 degree beam.
Right. So you had had this history of being interested in this question.
That's right.
And this was another attempt to
do
it. But I don't know of any other attempt where the same observers did both an interferometer and a single dish survey and tried to sort this out.
I think that's why we did it, I think. We decided to try and sort it out that way. And
Do you remember this paper having much of an impact at either the Paris Symposium?
There was quite a lot of discussion about it. There was a tremendous lot of discussion at the Paris Symposium.
Can you tell me your recollections of that meeting? I've always thought that was I wish I could have been at that meeting myself. It seems to me like it must have been a very interesting meeting.
There was a lot of discussion after the talk, and it we got an awful lot of argument on the floor. Particularly, I didn't have to do anything because we all started arguing. There was Mills, and I think Corey was there. I think Kennison was involved. We started getting into a lot of the arguments then as to what interferometers really did see and what they were missing and so on. And so a lot of the stuff which was to be solved in the next year did surface at that time. And the discussion was all the usual discussion about extended sources, whether they were playing a role and so on. I don't think actually that there was some discussion as to what interferometers were seeing. I don't think that there was any clear good answer or anybody really putting forward the dominant rotate by confusion and so on at that time. Still, I mean, a lot of papers about the whole thing got into a long involved argument about the merits and the usual thing of how you remember the idea of interferometers and so on, and what interferometers really saw.
Do you remember that there was also obviously the cosmological implications of the different surveys were different, and therefore that was entering into the discussion?
That's right. I mean, there were the differences getting in, if I remember rightly, arguing for what the Mills result and so on was and things like that. I think the argument was, you know, the argument basically was between the Australians and the Cambridge group, you know, and we were to some extent not directly involved in the sense that we didn't have a deep personal commitment in the result, although we didn't believe, we were very dubious about the interferometer.
Well, because your results here
that's
were
right.
favoring the
that's right.
the Mills.
I think we'd realised it was an awful lot of spurious. You know, there were some other things that had come into it somewhere along the line, which I can't remember exactly, where we'd where I think we'd found discrepancies and so on, which we couldn't reconcile and so on. I think there were probably other things, but I can't remember.
Discrepancies now. Between what and what?
Well, I think that, you know, between surveys and so on, or things that we couldn't find, something or other. I can't remember all these things. It's really difficult to remember.
Of course, there was a tremendous discrepancy between the 2C and the first installment of the Mills survey
in
the region of Overlap. I mean, that was the basic crux of the...
I can't remember whether there was some other stuff we were doing ourselves which influenced as well. I can't remember.
What do you think, in retrospect, I'd be interested in your opinion, was the resolution of it? Was it a matter that Mills basically had it right and the 2C was just... Confusion limited, or do you think?
The 2C was obviously wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's.
Do you think the P of E analysis was useful at all, or was that?
Just
a confusing issue.
Well, the P of D analysis was interesting. I think the P of D analysis was interesting in being. You know, I remember we discussed. You know that a lot of these. Ourselves, but a lot of this information must be in the ripple, in the background. And I think that Scheuer, did the first really good use of this type of thing, which is the way that you obviously should go. And I think we probably all realised it was, to some extent, it was to some extent a little bit silly counting sources and then binning them all and everything again, that you didn't have to do that sort of thing if you knew how to do it properly. And so the P of D analysis, I think, was very important from that point of view. Although I think that possibly how far it would resolve the issue was overestimated. You could push it down a little bit deeper, but I think there was rather wider claims made for it that you could really extend the whole thing much further. Than, you could actually go very, very much deeper. I don't think that was entirely true. You could go a reasonably small factor deeper, but you obviously couldn't go beyond the one source per... I mean, what you're really doing is, I was getting down about the one source per beam area sort of thing, essentially, I think. If you
in treating them statistically rather than knowing exactly which source is where.
You could get a little 2 or 3 times finger in a sense, and so it was a much better sort of thing, but I suppose that it probably didn't at that particular time have to clarify the issue because it wasn't so direct as the source counts, you know, so that...
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Can you remember anyone or... What's your impression of the fact? Did anyone was anyone convinced by P of D that they should believe the results of the 2C and the cosmology that came therefrom? Did it change anyone's opinion?
I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't have thought so that it was sufficiently clear cut to.
Yeah. Yet the Cambridge group, of course, even when they began to recognize that the 2C itself was unreliable, said, "No, but P of D is okay." But what you're saying is that you think that...
That's I don't think that... remember, I'm sure that they fell back on that. I mean, the P of D, I think people recognise the power of that. All I'm saying is I'm not quite sure whether it convinced... It obviously didn't convince anybody, you know, that was other people involved in the controversy, particularly strongly, because the argument went on quite... sometime afterwards, and I think that it obviously...
Why not? Why didn't it? You say it was important in showing that this was...
I think that people wanted to find out what was really wrong with the 2C. I think it obviously was a pretty big shock to find out what the source was spurious, and the question then, of course, you know, so it certainly was true that the really strong argument, the very, very steep slope for the evolution was all wrong. I mean, so the original claim on which the case for strong evolution was based was wrong, was erroneous. I mean, you really couldn't have based that claim on the original results. And now, then, of course, what you were doing was getting down to the much more difficult thing of trying to distinguish between a 1.5 and a 1.6 something, which is what the Australians had, because the Australians... Now, in a certain sense, actually, Mills did a very good analysis at that time, because... and I'm not sure whether he gets the full credit for what he did at that time, because he did it the opposite way around, I think, which was much mostly upon, I can't remember what he did this, but because I didn't know he'd done it long after, and I asked, and I think when I asked why it hadn't been done this way, and what he did was, he calculated, you see, what the effect on his counts would be from the confusion, and you know, to calculate that his slope would be increased, and it was on the basis that I think that he calculated that the slope wouldn't be 1.5, it would be 1.6 or something, that he was claiming that the things were consistent with a 1.5 thing. I mean, rather than the other way around, which was an alternative method and a more direct method of doing it. So the thing itself wasn't all that far, of course, in those days when one was dealing with fairly strong sources, wasn't all that far from the 1.5. And then the argument, of course, shifted.
Why was 1.5 of any interest? I mean, after all, in a non-Newtonian universe, you don't expect 1.5. Were there still people that thought that they might all be near the galaxy?
Well, whatever it was. I mean, I can't remember what the...
There was
in the beginning. That's right. And I think that then you got into the argument afterwards, of course, that the argument shifted slightly. That although the slope was near the 1.5... Well, I'll come back to something. All the slope nearly was 1.5. It shouldn't have been. That was then the argument, of course. It should have been wildly different from 1.5. And then I think some people probably started to get a little bit uneasy because it's unfortunately a problem that's cropped up in a lot of cosmological investigations over the years, that if you adopt a static Euclidean thing, many of the results fit it much better than they do in the revolving universes. It's the same with the angular size.
Right.
Relationship. It's the same with the V over VM test in QSOs. If you assume a static Euclidean, then you get the probability comes out. The average V over VM comes out about 0.5, which is what you expect. And I think people got a little bit worried.
Yeah, well, Kellerman had a lecture in which he pointed this out rather nicely around 1970. I don't know if you remember that.
No, well, I mean, this worried people all the time, I think. This was the thing that worried people.
At that time, I don't remember this question of being discussed, that really 1.5 always seems to be the standard that people are comparing against, and no one ever says, well, in fact, you never do really expect 1.5 kind of modern cosmology.
Oh, I think they were. I think that once you start to... By the end of the 1950s, 1960s, surely,
well,
in the
1960s. By the end of when?
In the early 1960s. Ryle and them were pointing this out when they're comparing...
Well, I'm thinking more of the late 50s. Where they were saying it was much different than 1.5, but
of course, at that time I think one wasn't taking into account very much the cosmological effects because we didn't really know how far away these things were.
That's what I'm getting at.
I mean, I think that they were so distant. I think probably the very bright ones wasn't. I mean,
but you needed to.
Well, you see, I think that in all of astronomy, I think one, in all of these things, one has to be a little bit careful in assessing how arguments go. The general impression you get if you read things that there's a whole sort of controversy going on involving everybody. And of course that isn't the way it happens. That what actually happens is that you have maybe two groups involved in it, or a couple of people that are spokesmen for it.
Yes.
And most of the people just sit and listen. I mean, one of the reactions I got from somebody in Paris when I gave that talk, you know, must have been saying before that I didn't believe any of this survey stuff. And so, well, that's very dangerous because Ryle knows what he's doing and so on. And that's the attitude of a lot of people in the whole game, that they listen to one or two people who are actually conducting the argument. Everybody isn't in the argument because everybody doesn't have all the data. Yeah. So everybody who's not actually doing number counts isn't particularly worrying about whether you put in the various cosmological corrections, which they would do perhaps if they sat down and start to do number counts. It's a thing I've always found when I start to tackle the problem, you usually find all kinds of faults in the analysis beforehand. But you don't do it until you sit down and do it. So people were sitting here and they sort of, some people in one camp and some in the other, but most people just sitting watching the argument develop between two groups, and they themselves weren't terribly worried. And I'm sure that people who are involved in cosmology would have probably gone straight to matrilineal, perhaps. But the argument developed into something different. The argument really didn't develop, you see, to some extent for a long time, as to whether or not what particular cosmology you were in, or whether, in fact, you mean what your interest was, is it consistent with some particular model? But the argument soon developed into the fact that you had two surveys which didn't agree at all anyhow, and gave completely different results.
But the two things got mixed up.
The two things got mixed up, and I think that's the way things go, the whole mix up.
Right. Probably. And of course, the steady state was particularly vulnerable to attack because it did make a specific prediction, which could be tested, although...
That particular form of it,
although there were two forms of it, and I'm not sure that was particularly appreciated by some of the...
Well, I think there was a mistake made, and I've said that too. I think the state was called steady state, and I don't believe that really was the argument. And to some extent, the argument really was whether it was creation or not, a big bang or not. And I think in that particular, if you switch to that particular form of the model, you know, these things, then I'm not even sure that controversy is settled yet.
Now, why do you say that, going back to the 50s, that was really the...
Well, I asked Gold, you say, oh, why do I say that? Oh, well, I asked Gold, let me say this first, I asked Gold once, why did they say the thing had to be, because in fact it was homogeneous when it was put into the thing in the beginning. That wasn't a necessity of a continuous creation model.
That'd be homogeneous.
Yeah. And he said, well, they consulted the best experts at the time, sort of thing, and they told it up to such a distance. The universe was homogeneous and isotropic, and I think one of the first things you learn about the universe is exactly not that, you know, really, mm-hmm. on these sort of scales. But by saying it was homogeneous on the sort of scale of a Hubble radius, they implicitly built into the thing that the thing was fixed and so on. If they hadn't made that assumption, they could have had all kinds of models, you know, it within the same context. Well, I don't know. I believe that. There were personalities involved in all that, and it's very difficult to. I don't know what was going on here, you know, in Cambridge at the time, but there obviously were personality things going on, which presumably is the way a lot of problems get resolved, because people stick firmly to the one line, so one people try to knock one lot down, and one people try to change everything. I think that. Why? I think that there are things happening which we don't understand ourselves. I think very emotive things possibly as well behind the Big Bang model and continuous creation. Some people didn't like the idea of continuous creation for some reason or other.
You mean predilections are really more philosophical?
Or philosophical and so on, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the whole idea of the steady state thing was philosophical, in a certain sense. Well, it obviously was. We didn't like the discontinuity and in the whole thing. Now, why people don't like discontinuity again is another philosophical question.
Yeah,
but I'm sure that if you read the writings, and Lovell is fairly prone to this type of thing about the philosophical implications of various things and so on, you know, as to how they react. I mean, I don't see it that way myself, but...
But you would say that the participants in this thing would not give much weight to that kind of thing having much influence on their arguments.
I think it probably had a bigger influence than they...
Than they would admit.
Than they would know, possibly.
Yeah.
I think, I'm sure that you... I think there was a lot, and I think it was distorted here by personality problems.
Yeah, sure.
But I'm sure it played a tremendous role in the way in which radio astronomy developed in Cambridge, because the development of a lot of the instrumentation and the way in which the problems went were, in fact, geared to cosmology.
Right, to source counts.
Source counts and so on. And so it had a very strong positive impact in the development of new techniques.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is maybe one of the ways where perhaps the whole study got a bit distorted and the emphasis was far too much to well, I'm not putting it too unkindly, it hasn't been terribly profitable, the whole thing so far. I'll tell you one other thing, actually. There are many of us, I think, were a bit reluctant to believe that by counting 25 sources or 50 sources or so on, you could solve the structure of the universe. I mean, so there were some of us, I think, who were a bit dubious about the whole operation anyhow, because on the data that was available at that time, you felt it.
So you mean those were the brightest, and so much of it was based on that.
That's right. I mean, I still find it a little bit, you know, that you can stick a few pieces of wire together and count 50 sources and say, well, we've solved everything. You know, I think some people thought it was a bit simplistic, I think, to think about it was as simple as that.
Well, but are you saying if you stick a few pieces of wire together and count 10,000 sources, that might be able to do it?
Well, I think when you solved it, I think that, you know, it all seemed a bit too simple. You know, I think, you know.
So you're saying that really investigating cosmology scientifically may be a bit naive.
Well, it's obviously a bit naive when we, in a certain extent, when we don't know what we're dealing with. A lot of it is obviously, you know, there are when you're looking for what are fairly subtle effects and so on, and I think this has been borne out in many cases, I think you find deviations and various things occurring in the data, and I think that you have to be a little bit careful in interpreting these to particular cosmological effects when you don't really understand the physics of the objects and all kinds of other effects that are going on. So I think we all want to solve the cosmological problem in the bottom line.
Now, we've been talking about cosmology specifically and talking about some quote-unquote non-scientific elements that enter into it. Is this true of the rest of astronomy or radio astronomy also, or has it really come out only in cosmology?
I think it comes out mainly in cosmology, but I think that to some extent a lot of the rest of the work is connected. I think it comes out. There are certain non-scientific things come out in any science. I think that the idea that you have the whole scientific community being involved in an argument isn't in fact true. It's usually the argument occurs from two polarized camps and.
So the idea of checks, you mean?
Well, the idea that science is some objective search after truth is just a lot of nonsense. I mean, that I think maybe science is, but that isn't the way science isn't done in that way, and I don't think it would get done in that way. What it depends is some people in general taking up some extreme position and they're maybe holding the field for quite a long time because they might be the most vociferous.
Most influential arguer.
And then somebody else will take it up. And most people, you know, haven't spent enough time in various disciplines and to be able to really take a very firm role in it. Now, and if it's on some peripheral thing, then of course nobody ever does. And it's only, I think, over a long period of time, averaged over people, that you get this objective thing in the end that... So I think that that science can obviously go wrong quite dramatically over a short period because of this thing. It depends on who gets the money, who gets the say, how influential they are.
The checks of experimental results doesn't work because it's just so much effort that only a few people actually
ever involved in the particular investigation. I think that's the thing. There's a lot of money involved, a lot of time involved. And so I think that it's a relatively small number of people who are involved actually in tackling a particular problem at any particular time. And I think possibly if they all agree, maybe this argument we were seeing in the 1950s is a very healthy state of affairs, because if everybody had agreed with some of the arguments, we might have gone even more wrong at that time. So there is personality plays a role, and then I think cosmology is particularly prone, for obvious reasons, I think it gets down to the root of the problem. And at the present time, I think it's very difficult to figure things out. But I think we get back to something you want to talk about, is this extraterrestrial stuff. I mean, I'm very interested, in a certain way, as to why people are interested in this